and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today we'll be featuring articles from Yahoo Sports, from the Washington Post, from Religion News Service, and more. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind or print impaired. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article from a source I don't think we've ever featured before, and it's pretty rare that we would. It's from Yahoo Sports, but it's in the aftermath of the passing of Kobe Bryant, and an article that I found very interesting. The headline, "Mourners Pay Their Respects at Kobe Bryant's Church." This is dated February 2nd by Jeff Eisenberg of Yahoo Sports, Dateline Newport Beach, California. Midway through a special Sunday Mass honoring loved ones who had recently died, 8-year-old Jenna Murray glanced over her shoulder and spotted a familiar face in the back of the church. "Mom," she said, "that's Kobe Bryant." When her mom brushed her off, Jenna repeated herself more forcefully. "No, Mom, that's Kobe." It was indeed Kobe Bryant, seated in a pew to the rear of Our Lady Queen of Angels Church in Newport Beach, California. He was there with his wife Vanessa and their daughters that November 2007 day, just as he was many times since then. Jenna's mother insisted that she and her younger brother not bother Kobe at church, especially on a day that he might have been grieving the loss of someone he knew. Of course, Sean and Jenna did not listen. When Sean spotted Kobe outside the church after Mass was over, he ran up to the Los Angeles Lakers star and shook his hand. Sean told Kobe that he and his dad were diehard fans, that he wanted to play basketball because of him, that any time he joined a new team, he always asked to wear Kobe's number. To Sean's delight, Kobe responded graciously. He thanked Sean, patted him on the head, and gave him a few basketball pointers before excusing himself to return to his family. "It meant a lot to me," said Sean, now a student at Loyola Marymount. "He was my idol, my role model. It was so cool to see that he was just like us and that he went to some of the same places in the neighborhood that we did." Stories like Sean's are common among parishioners of Our Lady Queen of Angels Church and other Catholic churches across Orange County. Kobe was a Catholic whose faith mattered enough to him that he not only frequently attended Sunday Mass, but also occasionally went to weekday Mass as well. One of the last things Kobe did before last Sunday morning's helicopter crash that killed him, his 13-year-old daughter Gianna, and seven others, was to stop by Our Lady Queen of Angels and take communion. Father Steve Salat declined comment to Yahoo Sports, citing the family's request for privacy, but he told Currents News earlier this week that he ran into Kobe shortly before the start of 7 a.m. Mass last Sunday. "There was a little holy water on his forehead, so I knew that he had gone into the chapel to pray and then came out and blessed himself," Salat said. "We spoke for a minute, shook hands, and then off he went." Though the website for Our Lady Queen of Angels notes that the church mourns the loss of our parishioners Gianna and Kobe Bryant, the tragedy received only a brief mention during Sunday morning's 7 a.m. Mass. One of the pastors called for special prayers that Kobe, Gianna, and the other crash victims rest in peace and that their families find healing. "Let us pray to the Lord," the pastor said. "Lord, you have our prayers," his congregation responded in unison. Among the several hundred worshipers who attended the church's 7 a.m. Sunday Mass were a handful of people clad in Lakers gear. Luchi San Jose, age 36, and Peyton Alferos, age 16, are lifelong Lakers fans who woke up before dawn to drive 30 miles from their homes in Carson to attend Mass at the same church Kobe visited the previous Sunday. San Jose wore Kobe's signature Nike shoes and a T-shirt bearing a purple and gold interlocking L.A. logo, while Alferos had Kobe's number 24 jersey over his white sweatshirt. "Rather than go to our regular church this morning, we thought that it would be more meaningful coming here," Alferos said. Paco Frausto, a devout Catholic from Huntington Beach, had similar reasons for making a short drive to Newport Beach early Sunday morning. Wearing a black Lakers T-shirt over his usual button-down shirt and tie, Frausto sat near the back of the church because that's what he heard that Kobe usually did. "I came to see where he was last week and to reminisce," Frausto said. "I feel a little bit more of a connection as a result." Kobe didn't speak about his Catholic faith very often before his death, but it's clear that it helped him overcome one of the most difficult ordeals of his life. In a 2015 interview with GQ magazine, Kobe divulged that he regularly spoke with a priest after a 19-year-old Colorado woman accused him of rape 12 years earlier. Though prosecutors dropped the case in 2004 and Kobe and his wife reconciled after he publicly apologized to her, the priest helped the Lakers star accept that a segment of the general public was never going to forgive him for what they thought he did. "The one thing that really helped me during that process, I'm Catholic, I grew up Catholic, my kids are Catholic, was talking to a priest," Kobe told GQ. "It was actually kind of funny. He looks at me and says, 'Did you do it?' And I say, 'Of course not.' Then he asks, 'Do you have a good lawyer?' And I'm like, yeah, he's phenomenal. So he just said, 'Let it go, move on. God's not going to give you anything you can't handle, and it's in his hands now. This is something you can't control, so let it go.' And that was the turning point." It's unclear how often Kobe attended church prior to that, but it was definitely part of his routine thereafter. In a Facebook post earlier this week, Orange County Bishop Timothy Fryer described Kobe as a committed Catholic who loved his family and loved his faith. Kobe would frequently attend Mass and sit in the back of the church so that his presence would not distract people from focusing on Christ's presence, Fryer wrote. Christina Ballestero recalls doing a double take when Kobe walked into weekday Mass and sat down beside her 6 years ago at a church in Orange, California. After respectfully stepping aside to allow Ballestero to go in front of him to receive communion, Kobe paid the accomplished singer a compliment, telling her, "Hey, you have a really beautiful voice." Seeing Kobe in that setting humanized him for Ballestero, who grew up in a basketball-crazed family and played a year of varsity basketball herself. "It was a very surreal experience," Ballestero said. "It was so cool to see somebody who has that much success and that much fame come to pray like all of us, like anyone of faith. Someone with that much money usually might not think they need to lean on God, but faith was clearly very important to him." Memorable as it was for Sean Murray to meet Kobe at church as a 7-year-old, it's his second encounter with the Lakers legend that he'll cherish even more. About a year ago, Kobe and Gianna visited the Costa Mesa In-N-Out where Sean worked. "I ran over to take his money for his order. I shook his hand again, and I reminded him of the first time we met," Sean said. "I was making Gianna laugh because I was totally freaking out that I got to see him again." At the end of their brief chat, Kobe looked at the name tag on Sean's shirt. "Sean," he said, "I'll remember that." That conversation came rushing back into Sean's mind last Sunday when he learned that his favorite player and one-time idol had died. He retold the story over the phone to his sister Jenna, who burst into tears at the memory of Kobe's kindness 12 years ago. Sean and Jenna are as crushed as anyone in the Los Angeles area that Kobe is gone, but their shared Catholic faith gives them reason for hope. "Knowing that Kobe is dunking on Jesus in heaven right now, it's the most comforting feeling in the world," Jenna said. "The sky is truly purple and gold for him forever." Our next article on religion in the news this week comes from the Washington Post, dated February 6th. The headline, "Methodist minister at George Mason University could face discipline over officiating a same-sex wedding." This is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. A Methodist-ordained minister from Northern Virginia could be one of the last members of the clergy in the United Methodist Church to face disciplinary action for officiating at a same-sex wedding ceremony. The Reverend Drew Enns, age 35, who works at a Rise campus ministry at George Mason University in Fairfax County, conducted the marriage in September. Such unions are prohibited by Methodist doctrine, but church trials over same-sex marriage have become increasingly controversial in recent years, with a growing number of congregations and individuals supportive of both same-sex marriage and LGBTQ clergy. In early January, leaders in the United Methodist Church tentatively agreed to spin off a traditionalist Methodist denomination that would continue to oppose same-sex marriage and decline ordination to LGBT clergy, allowing the remaining portion of the United Methodist Church to permit same-sex marriage and LGBT clergy for the first time in its history. The plan will be voted on at the church's denomination-wide conference in May. The proposal between Methodist leaders outlining a future split suggested that clergy who conduct same-sex marriages should remain in good standing and that any judicial processes should be put on hold as of January 1st. But in a January 17th letter, Bishop Sharma Lewis of the Virginia Conference announced that she would continue to process complaints, including against ENDS, until the church's rulebook, the Book of Discipline, is changed. The book says the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. The letter was first reported by DCist. ENDS said he was asked to officiate the wedding by one of the grooms, whom he had confirmed and was a youth minister to. He declined to provide more details about the wedding to protect the couple's privacy. "I knew it was a risk," he said. "I couldn't sit by and not do something when this couple had invited me to officiate their wedding." He said he is surprised his disciplinary case is still open, while others have been put on pause. Bishop Sharma Lewis is bound by oaths she took as both a pastor and a bishop to uphold the Book of Discipline, and she processed both complaints, Paul Steidler, a spokesman for the bishop, said in a statement. Methodist church trials over same-sex marriages have been controversial since 2013, when a Pennsylvania pastor was defrocked after officiating at his son's marriage to another man. Other pastors have gone through mediation with their accusers after performing a same-sex ceremony. The denomination uses an internal judicial system with judges and trials led by clergy. In 2019, the church adopted new penalties effective January 1st. The mandatory penalty for officiating a same-sex marriage would be a year's suspension without pay, and a second conviction would mean a pastor would be defrocked. ENDS, whose ministry at George Mason is ecumenical, said that because this was his first offense, he doesn't expect his credentials to be pulled. If they were, ENDS might be able to seek credentials from a different conference. Because his ministry is ecumenical, it would probably still keep him on staff, he said. But his ties to the UMC are deep, and it's the denomination he grew up in. "It would be incredibly hard to leave," he said. "This is my spiritual home and what I've known." Two complaints were filed against ENDS after he conducted the wedding, including from the Reverend Amanda Miller Garber, pastor of Rise Church in Harrisonburg, Virginia, who herself had conducted a same-sex ceremony in 2014. She was suspended without pay for a month. Disciplinary actions are worked out at the local level, and Miller said that she thought if she filed a friendly complaint, ENDS might be dealt with less harshly. "I had a different bishop. I hoped the system might respond differently," she said. The second complaint was not what you would call friendly, Miller said. Neither she nor ENDS would say who submitted the complaint, citing an ongoing process. Steve Brown, chancellor for the Virginia Conference, said that the names of the complainants are confidential. He said that there is no way to predict the speed of the process or whether anything will be decided before the denominational meeting in May. John Lamparis, a United Methodist who advocates with the traditionalist Protestant group Institute on Religion and Democracy, said that the bishop and ENDS might agree to a just resolution, which is like an out-of-court settlement. "Even when all the rules are being followed and upheld with integrity, it is typically a long process before a church trial is held," Lamparis said in an email. "I would expect everyone is waiting to first see what shakes out of our May General Conference." Our next article this week on Religion in the News comes from Religion News Service dated January 30th. This is a story headlined, "Journalist Gwen Ifill Remembered with Stamp at Her Washington Church." And this is by Adele M. Banks of Religion News Service, Dateline, Washington. In the historic black church where she worshipped, the late journalist Gwen Ifill was remembered with a new black heritage stamp in a ceremony featuring dignitaries of the church, politics, and journalism. Speakers at the event Thursday, January 30th at Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church took turns describing Ifill's courage in defying expectations and praised her faith-fueled ability to serve as a mentor to young journalists who followed in her footsteps. "The founders of Imperial America never intended for Gwen to be Gwen," the Reverend William H. Lamar IV, pastor of Metropolitan AME Church, told the hundreds gathered for the Forever Stamp ceremony. "But the founders of the African Methodist Episcopal Church did intend for Gwen to be Gwen, and for a million Gwens to follow Gwen Ifill." Deputy Postmaster General Ronald A. Stroman said the U.S. Postal Service considered many settings for the ceremony for the 43rd stamp in its Black Heritage series, but determined the Washington Church was the appropriate venue. "Her faith grounded her," he said just before unveiling a supersized version of the stamp before the large cross at the front of the sanctuary. It gave her strength and informed the values that guided her life. Eiffel, the first African-American and first woman to moderate a major television news analysis show, died at age 61 in 2016 after a cancer diagnosis. She was the moderator and managing editor of Washington Week and senior political correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Eiffel became co-anchor of the PBS NewsHour, part of the first all-woman team to anchor a national nightly news program. Earlier in her career, she worked for newspapers including the Washington Post and the New York Times. The ceremony featured remembrances from friends and colleagues, including Post contributing columnist Michelle Norris, who served as mistress of ceremonies, and Eiffel's NewsHour co-host Judy Woodruff, who noted the stamp dedication occurred during the same week when the life of their mentor Jim Lehrer will be remembered after his death on January 23rd. Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser issued a proclamation declaring Gwen Eiffel Day in her city. Former President Bill Clinton sent a video with remarks welcoming the journalist's recognition, and former Attorney General Eric Holder read a congratulatory statement from former President Barack Obama. Eiffel's brother, the Reverend Earl Eiffel, said it was significant to have his sister's memory honored at an African Methodist Episcopal church affiliated with a denomination in which she was an active part and her relatives held prominent roles. It is delightful and meaningful in the fact that not only is it an honor for her and for us as a family, but for the AME Church as a whole, as she has spent her life in service to the church. Eiffel, who retired in 2019 as the presiding elder of the denomination's Atlanta East District, said in a phone interview during earlier this week. Known for her broadcast and print journalism and moderating of election season debates, Gwen Eiffel was also the daughter of parents who were natives of the Caribbean and who became deeply involved in the AME Church. Her father, a minister, eventually became its general secretary, a post he still held when he died in 1991, and her mother was active in the denomination's Women's Missionary Society. Eiffel had sung in choirs from the time of her youth and found local AME churches to join as her career moved her to the Boston area, Baltimore, and Washington, her brother said. She joined Metropolitan in 1989 and, among other activities, narrated special programs, such as a presentation of Handel's Messiah. Patricia Ann Morris DeVoe, the wife of Bishop William DeVoe, a former pastor at Metropolitan, wrote of recruiting Eiffel for the congregation's Voices of Inspiration. Gwen joined the choir and sang in the alto section, known as the Toes, wearing the royal blue and gold robe and marching down the aisle with us, illuminating the sanctuary with her smile, she recalled, in a statement printed in the Christian Recorder, the AME Church's newspaper, shortly after the journalist's death. The altos were our largest section of the choir, and Gwen helped them rock the house. Eiffel, who was also cited with a plaque on a pew at Metropolitan, connected her roles in the press and the pew on at least one occasion. I would actually get a pass from my own pastor not to go to church on Sundays if I was going to be on Meet the Press, she said during a special tribute to her colleague Tim Russert on NBC days after his death in 2008. Eiffel is not the first member of her denomination to be pictured on a U.S. stamp. Among others are Richard Allen, the AME Church's first bishop, who was honored in the same sanctuary with a Black Heritage stamp in 2016 to mark the denomination's 200-year anniversary. Sherilyn Eiffel, president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, said the addition of her cousin to the list of stamp honorees, who range from Harriet Tubman to Marvin Gaye, has elevated her from the days as a preacher's daughter when faith and excellence in school were the priorities, and not parties or fashionable clothes. The expectation was clearly defined, and being cool was not on the agenda, Sherilyn Eiffel said. But today, Gwen is the coolest. We'll continue on religion in the news with an article from the Associated Press. This is dated February 4th. The title, Moving Faith, Mexican Town's Saint Feast Lives in Minnesota. This is by Giovanna Delorto of the AP, Dateline Minneapolis. In Midwestern boots or bare feet and sandals, the faithful walked in procession down a snow-covered street here, keeping the rhythm of festive music and carrying paintings of St. Paul, the patron saint of their hometown of Oxochiapan, Mexico. for the thousands of migrants from the South Mexico town 2,200 miles away who have built new lives in Minnesota over the last two decades, throwing a wild two-day bash for St. Paul's Catholic Feast Day in January is a crucial way to celebrate their roots and feel a bit more at home, closer to the families they left behind. It's even more important because we brought it here, says Apolinar Morales, this year's steward of the celebration, who left Axochiapan in 1989. The meaning is not to lose our traditions so that they can be kept alive even though we're far, and we want our kids and grandkids to remember this. He estimates that more than a third of Axochiapan's residents migrated to the United States, most of them about 20 years ago when the celebration started here. The festival here is especially important for those participants who can't go home for the month-long celebration in Axochiapan because of their immigration status. Most are raising U.S. children for whom this feast is the biggest chance to be immersed in the Mexican part of their identities. It helps them learn to live the faith of their ancestors instead of just sticking the venerated painting of St. Paul in a corner, as Morales, age 50, fears the younger generations would do. Our families in Axochiapan are happy because we're enjoying the same celebration in the same way as they are. Well, except it's hot there, said, grinning, Silverio Camillo. On the feast vigil, he stirred with a yard-long wooden spatula some 120 pounds of corn dough, slowly cooking in Morales' suburban garage as flurries fell steadily outside. Volunteers like him didn't sleep for a few days to prepare the chicken tamale and mole dinners they would serve to the 1,200 people who participate in masses, processions, and dances at the Church of the Incarnation, Sagrado Corazon, in South Minneapolis. To sacrifice time and money as an offering of faith is just as central to honoring St. Paul as the exuberant dancing, many said. Faith is to believe that you make an effort and in return get joy and maybe a blessing, such as work, said Camilo, who was a teen when he came from Axochiapan 22 years ago. Among the most time-consuming efforts is creating the processional three-foot candles, each studded with a dozen wax pink and yellow flowers. The faithful began pouring, painting, and decorating the wax in September, and this summer they'll start over in whatever colors the next steward picks. The candle tradition dates back at least 60 years, but the celebration itself has far longer roots across continents and even beliefs. In 1542, the Spanish conquistadors took over an Aztec settlement and renamed it in honor of St. Paul, who persecuted the first Christians until a revelation on the road to Damascus turned him into the apostle to the nations, taking the new faith beyond the Middle East. It's his conversion that's celebrated on January 25th and represented in the paintings venerated in Axochiapan and Minneapolis. Legend has it that the painting miraculously refused to go to Axochiapan unless carried in a procession of dancers, according to Morales. So now, even in 27-degree weather, bare-chested Aztec dancers preceded a replica of the image down a quiet Minneapolis street, their leg bracelets made with dozens of large ayote seeds rattling at the beat of tambourines accompanied by a conch-shell horn. The rattle was a bit muted when dancers, having left their ornate 6-foot feather headdress on the pews, made their way to receive communion at Mass inside the 101-year-old church. Or perhaps it was just drowned out by the trumpets and strings of the mariachi band that was playing Pescador de Hombres, one of the best-loved modern Catholic hymns in the Spanish-speaking world. For several members of the Aztec troops, indigenous dancing was yet another form of devotion to St. Paul, and a way to find peace in inevitably mixed identities. It means a lot to see the sacrifice, the level of respect toward the regalia, the prayers, the dance itself, that identify us as Mexicans, said dancer Carla Cortez Ocampo, age 29, who grew up in Minneapolis. Many kids don't speak Spanish well, but they respect what it takes to stay in the dance circle. In fact, the sense of belonging found in faith and its rituals is crucial to many migrant communities. Religion provides one of the few culturally familiar and deeply rooted places available to them, said the Reverend Kevin McDonough, the priest of this diverse parish. He started his homily by telling the several hundred faithful his counterpart in Axochiapan had phoned to wish them a happy holiday. On the last night, incense smoke from smoldering embers of copal, a tropical tree, wafted among the giant candles as the procession returned in the darkness to the church. where more hours of dancing followed in front of a massive altar festooned with banners celebrating San Pablo Apostol and Minneapolis Patronal Feast. The banners, the copal, even most of the dancers' handmade regalia came from Mexico for the occasion, but one man solemnly carrying a candle wore a Viking's cap. "People feel comfortable at home," said Morales of this celebration that migrants like him took with them. "We're proud that we brought it here to Minneapolis. I brought the best that I could." We'll wrap up this week's edition of Religion in the News with a short news brief from the AP, headlined, "Facebook takes down anti-Semitic page, Governor says." This is from February 5th, Dateline, Trenton, New Jersey. Facebook has agreed to shutter the public page of a group the administration has identified as anti-Semitic, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said Wednesday. Murphy, a Democrat, said in a joint statement with Attorney General Gurbir Grewal that the social media giant agreed to take down the public page of a group called Rise Up Orange Ocean County, which purported to be focused on development in the shore community. "We appreciate that Facebook has now decided that this kind of hateful rhetoric has no place on its platform," Murphy and Grewal said in the statement. Facebook determined the page violated community standards for hate speech, company spokesman Daniel Roberts said in an email. The page was removed Wednesday. The development comes after Grewal's office wrote in April to Facebook to make the social network aware of the page. Among the posts on the group page, according to the Attorney General, was a video in which the group predicted that a group of Orthodox rabbis would lead to the colonization of Lakewood in Ocean County. Another comment on the site referenced the Holocaust and called for getting rid of them like Hitler did, according to the Attorney General. Facebook last year cracked down on what it called dangerous individuals, banning accounts it said violated its policy. The company has said it has always banned people or groups that proclaim a violent or hateful mission or are engaged in acts of hate or violence, regardless of political ideology. For years, social media companies have been under pressure from civil rights groups and other activists to clamp down on hate speech in their services. After the deadly white nationalist protests in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, Google, Facebook, and PayPal began banishing extremist groups and people who identified as or supported white supremacists. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today's broadcast was generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you'd like to take our episodes with you as a podcast, they're available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org, click the Listen tab, and then along the left side, look for Religion in the News under the podcast heading. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News. If you see a story you'd like to see featured on an upcoming episode, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.